Well, the clock on the wall and that music signifies it's time for Spectrum West. The curtain's up. Thanks for being here. I'm Al Ross. We never have a problem filling this show every week, all year round. That's because you guys are busy keeping yourselves busy and engaged in the music, arts, and humanities. All I have to do is get you to sit still long enough to talk about it so others know and can participate. Today's lineup features an Eau Claire author who just released her new science fiction novel, the annual garden tour that raises needed support for stepping stones of Dunn County, people depending on and people coming through for other people. The Volume 1 family of writers and columnists has a new print magazine and electronic media site designed for your family called Chippewa Valley Family. We'll talk about it from origin to distribution. It's hot off the presses. And here's where we begin today. The St. Croix River, its designation as a national park, is very much who we are in West Wisconsin. It's a natural resource and a history we share with Minnesota neighbors. The history is important to maintain and share, and one person doing that is Gene Sheppy Anderson, a National Park Service employee who deals with cultural resources, presenting programs for us to appreciate. One is called Ruins of a Forgotten Highway, Underwater Archaeology of the St. Croix River. And it's this evening, Thursday, at the Stillwater, Minnesota Library. If you're listening Friday, you can watch for other programs because there are a lot along the St. Croix. Tell us a bit about what a National Park Service historian engages in.
Initially, what I was an interpreter, so I was one of the public who talks to the public about what goes on in the park, and I was working primarily in historic parks, so that worked well. And then over the years, I've done more where I'm looking up information on some of the tidbits of history for the park, and also other cultural resource components. So as part of the National Park Service, we have an obligation to not harm any of the historic properties that might be on our land. So when we're putting in signs, putting in new toilets for the campsites on the river, we have to bring in archaeologists to look and see that there's no archaeological sites that we're disturbing. And so I work a lot with archaeologists to do that. And we have a small museum collection here I'm responsible for. So it's the whole kind of component of what you would fall under the title cultural resources.
You literally are a cultural resource, and in addition to all the other things that you just mentioned.
Well, I've been here 25 years on the St. Croix now, so I have learned a fair amount about some of the history of the valley.
But you mentioned in your dossier that you early on moved around. Is it the nature of a National Park Service employee or a ranger to bounce around early?
Yes. One, to gain experience so you can get hopefully promotions down the way, but typically the only way to get to promotions is to move on to another park.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, the early years are when you do a lot of your moving. In my case, then I stopped. And if you really wanted to advance with a career in the Park Service, you would continue to move. I chose not to.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, if you are an employee of the National Park Service, getting some exposure to all the parks or more parks than just one in that category of national, it makes sense.
Yep. It really is fun because you get to learn an awful lot about that park's history.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're national parks, it means that they're a history that's important to all of us. So whether it's the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, presidents, homes, you know, also places like prehistoric Indian burial grounds. I enjoyed the diversity of exposure I got.
Jean Sheppy Anderson is with us on the telephone. She is a river historian, at least in the context of what we're talking about today. And that is a presentation called Ruins of a Forgotten Highway, Underwater Archaeology of the St. Croix River, being presented Thursday evening at the Stillwater, Minnesota Public Library. You know, Gene, I never thought about it, but in some of the material that you sent, you used a term historic architects.
It's people who have an architectural background, but they also have studied historic homes. So it's more of them looking at historic structures and being able to tell you something about how they were constructed at that time period. What are the things that are important to maintain in a structure of that age to give it integrity for the future.
Historic architects design ways to show people how history has unfolded. That's kind of architecture in its own way, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is.
So what historic assets does the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway contain?
We have a lot of archaeological sites, and they stretch from prehistoric times up through the lumbering era and early settlement. So that's probably our largest resources. We also have 4 historic cabins that are eligible to the National Register that kind of tell the early recreational history of the river when families began to gain cars and suddenly could drive and have their own cabin along the river rather than staying in lodges, which were more often found on lakes.
Are they all within close proximity to each other, or are they spread up and down the river? Or what?
They're spread up and down the river.
So access to them is gained how?
Some of them are accessible by road. Some are only accessible by water. It really varies. And a lot of the archaeological sites, you know, we don't tell the public anything about where they are because we don't want to risk them being damaged.
What's a typical day for Jean Sheppy Anderson? What kinds of things do you do from morning till you go home?
It will be either looking up the answer to a question that maybe a visitor's posed or an employee wants to know to include in a program or something. It may be working with archaeologists to try to figure out what we need to do to keep an area protected. It may be working in the museum collection. It may be working with the public, you know, doing a program or answering questions. Or it may just be sitting and reading sometimes.
Ah, cool. Well, it sounds interesting. I mean, it sounds like you have variety. That's what makes jobs fun to stay with, and you've done that. One big resource as well is a human one, and I was interested to read that you, I don't know if you personally, but your people talk to other people, and they get their recollections as part of the historic documentation.
Yes, we do oral history. So, you know, we're a relatively new park. We were only created in 1968. So some of the people are still alive who were around for our creation. Mm-hmm. And some of the families go back for generations along the river. And so we try to find some of those people and if they're willing to sit down and talk with us so we can record what their perceptions of the river were, what they know their family, how they use the river, what changes they've seen over the years. Kind of helps fill in the gaps in knowledge of what this river's been like.
Mm-hmm. And where do their recollections end up? What form are they stored in?
We have them both recorded. Originally, they were done on reel-to-reel tapes and then cassette tapes, and now we do them on digital tapes. And we also try to print out a transcription, so we type up what they've said. And then they're available when we have either researchers come in or if we're doing a project and we're looking for a quote or information about a certain topic, we'll go in and look to see if any of the individuals have talked on that.
Thursday's presentation is called Ruins of a Forgotten Highway. It's at the Stillwater, Minnesota Public Library, beginning at 6:30. You're sharing the stage with Jessica Keller. She's an archaeologist, one of the people you talked about. This presentation is about what had to be done back when to make the river a navigable highway.
Correct. In the 1860s, Congress passed legislation that set up the Army Corps of Engineers with an office in St. Paul, Minnesota, to improve navigation on the Mississippi River and the tributaries, which included the St. Croix. And in the 1870s, they came up to the St. Croix and looked to see what was here, how deep the water was, and whether or not they thought they could make it a navigable river for boats.
Mm-hmm. I read the term 3-foot shipping channel. Is that right?
That's correct. For the St. Croix, navigation is stopped at St. Croix Falls, Taylor's Falls, because there was a series of rapids that stretched miles and then had like a 60-foot drop over that. So boats couldn't go up river beyond that point. So from St. Croix Falls south, what they tried to do was create a 3-foot channel. And at that time, that would have been deep enough for all boats that would have been operating on the St. Croix River.
That fascinated me. 3 feet is not real deep.
Not very deep. And with time, they did take the lower river, which had more commercial navigation than the upper river did, and they extended it. So it actually got as deep as 9 feet, had a 9-foot channel, which was based in part because when they put the locks and dam system on the Mississippi backed up into the St. Croix and raised it.
Hmm.
So the lower part of the river is actually higher than it was historically.
Uh-huh. Cool.
Because of the locks and dams.
Listening to historians, we do find out what people years ago did in service to a river. In 2015, what is our biggest job in relation to waterways? Is it just keeping them pristine? What is it?
That's probably the hardest thing to do because rivers are not isolated things. They're fed by creeks and streams and mm-hmm. springs that are all coming in from a much larger area, making up the watershed.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of areas where they can get exposed to pollutants or chemicals or other things. Siltation can happen. And so all of that impacts the river. And so that's one of the things that we really try to yeah. work on. And also balancing recreation into that as well.
Yeah, I mean, years ago, people were figuring out how to help the river help them, to serve them. Today, it's more or less us keeping them going, keeping them clean, and keeping all the people treating it in as much the same way as possible.
Yeah, and it pays back because a lot of people really love to canoe and boat and fish and camp along this river. So it's been a worthy endeavor.
Thursday's presentation, we have people who listen to this show on the repeat on Fridays, so they would have missed it if they didn't go. Do you have other programs like Thursday's Ruins of a Forgotten Highway that you guys put on?
We do a variety of programming. One thing is on Wednesday and Thursday evenings, we've been doing a pontoon ride north of the Stillwater area on the river,
okay.
talking about some of the history of that particular area, Stillwater Islands, it's called,
mm-hmm.
and the logging industry that's tied to all of that. And then we do periodically programs at our visitor centers during the winter. We have a speaker series where we bring speakers in to talk about both natural and cultural components of the riverway.
I have to make sure that people understand that you were courageous in doing the interview today because you have a summer cold. Thank you for doing that.
You're welcome.
Get rid of that cold.
I'll try.
Jean Sheppy Anderson, she is with the National Park Service, the St. Croix National Riverway. That's vital to western Wisconsin. It's a border of ours, and it's close to our hearts. Jean, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure, you're welcome.
Rivers, lakes, streams, creeks, let's not take them for granted. They've been the veins through which our resources have run long before we came to depend on them, and it's our job to be sure they continue to flow long after we're just a memory. Again, Thursday evening's presentation at the Stillwater Public Library begins at 6:30. Boatloads of information is at the website www.nps.gov/SACN. Coming up, Jim Oliver has a science fiction novel to tell you about. A Garden Show supports a very good neighbor, and Volume 1 turns up the volume with a new adventure. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Simply Done in Downsville, a place for gifts, ideas, and space for events. Home of Dunn County Pottery, featuring wood-fired pottery and fair trade gifts. More at Simply Done. I'm sorry, more at simply-dunndone.com. And you know, support also comes from the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild presenting Joseph in the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, a musical about the trials and tribulations of an Old Testament dreamer. June 25th to the 28th at the State Theater. Details and tickets at cvtg.org. Spectrum West, final one for June of 2015. I'm Al Ross. Good to have you along. This week, it's not the theater that is Jim Oliver's focus, although he will have his usual look at what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues coming up. But on this program, Jim has read another book. It's called Nova, and he wants us to meet the author. She's a writer who lives in our neighborhood.
Nova grabbed me from the first chapter and never let go. What a ride! Unforgettable, fast-paced, and original. This book kept me guessing to the end. That's from Amy Kaufman, a New York Times best-selling co-author of These Broken Stars. Nova, the first in a 5-book science fiction series written by Eau Claire author Margaret Fortune, was released early this month by Daw Books, a publisher of science fiction and fantasy books since 1971. Margaret Fortune joins us to talk about her book, her writing, and whatever else she feels like telling us. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's get started, and you can just tell us about the book.
Okay, well, Nova is the story of Leah Johansson. She's a genetically engineered human bomb, and she comes onto the New Soul space station with one goal only, for her countdown to go down and for her to blow up, to go Nova and take out the space station. But her mission gets a little hitch when her countdown stops 2 minutes from the end. She wakes up to find out she's a dud, and suddenly she has a life she never expected to have. To make things worse, she has no plan B. She has no identity besides a name stolen from a dead POW, no memory of her past. What is she to do? Well, that's what the story Nova is about.
It is billed as the first in a five-book science fiction series. Do the books stand alone, or is this kind of a continuing saga?
This is a standalone novel, and it does stand by itself very well. In fact, I wrote it as a standalone. I didn't originally plan it to be a series. Each book actually has a different main character, so each book has its own story, but together they link up to form a much bigger story.
So we don't follow Leah through the course of the five books, or do we?
Well, you'll have to read the series to find out if Leah shows up in the other books.
Oh, shucks. I thought we were going to break some news here. Okay.
Well, no spoilers.
Well, early science fiction comics, radio, and television shows and movies are credited with building interest in the space program. But what do you attribute your interest in science fiction?
I've loved science fiction ever since I was a little girl. I grew up reading children's sci-fi from the library by authors like Louise Lawrence and H.M. Hoover. I grew up watching shows like Star Trek, TNG, and SeaQuest. So I've loved sci-fi since I was a kid. You know, and it's so great to work with sci-fi as a writer because there's so much freedom in it. You know, unlike contemporary fiction where you're sort of constrained by the rules of reality, with science fiction, space is the limit.
All I was going to get back to, is there a schedule for the release of the other books in the series? Are you writing them now, or are they done and just waiting to be released, or what?
I'm writing the books now. I don't have release dates for the next books yet, although based on my dates and my contracts, I'm guessing it's going to be about one book a year.
That sounds good. Being a writer is one thing. Getting published is quite something else again. Daw Books bills itself on its webpage as the foremost discoverer of the hottest talent among science fiction writers. Wow, that's pretty heady stuff. How did you come to that publisher's attention?
Well, that's a story that was years in the making.
Well, tell me how you really got started writing. Why don't we start from the beginning of your writing career until you got discovered by this book publisher?
Sure. So I graduated from college in 2003 with a degree in psychology and no job. And I didn't have a whole lot to do while I was out job hunting all the time. And I started writing fiction again, which I hadn't really done much for years, but had had an interest in my childhood. And I found that I really enjoyed it. And I started writing my first novel and kind of got hooked from there. And so I was writing ever since. And it was, I think, about in 2006 when I finished the first draft of my first actually decent novel that I was like, oh, maybe I should try to become an author. So I decided to try and pursue it seriously after that. And it was a pretty long journey. Nova is actually the third book I completed and polished and tried to get an agent for. So I want to say I finished Nova in December of 2012, and I started querying for an agent. That was my third go-around querying for an agent. But you know what they say, third time's the charm, right? So I was actually querying for 9 months, and in September of 2013, I queried my sort of my last batch of agents. I'd queried about 100 agents at that point. I queried my agent on a Tuesday. She requested the full manuscript on Friday, and Saturday evening at 11 o'clock at night, I had an email from her saying she wanted to represent me.
Wow.
pretty, yeah, it was the sort of email writer's dream of getting, especially anyone who's queried as many agents as I have for as many years. Mm-hmm. And so then we put it on submission in October. So basically, my hard part of the job was over at that point. Then it was up to my agent to see if she could sell it. Mm-hmm. And so we were on submission for quite some time. It wasn't until June of 2014 that, you know, I wake up to find an email in my inbox and it's like, oh yeah, Betsy Wolheim at Daw sent a one-line email saying this is a terrific book. But, you know, she hasn't mentioned an offer yet, so don't get your hopes, you know, up too much yet at this point. We'll touch base later and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. And then I get a call a few hours later and, hey, Margaret, this is your agent. I have some really, really, really good news. And I'm grabbing for the phone and what do you know? Daw had a deal, not just for the book, but they were ready to buy the whole series.
Wow. Well, that's terrific. She is Margaret Fortune, author of the science fiction book Nova. How have you supported yourself in all of this querying that you've been doing over the years? Did you actually find a job when you were killing time to write your
book? I did eventually manage to find a job. Yeah, I've worked various jobs. I've sort of worked office jobs. I worked in payroll for a while, mm-hmm. and I've worked in a lot of customer service type jobs, mm-hmm. worked in call centers. So that's how I supported myself.
Mm-hmm. Sort of like a lot of particularly artistic professions where you have to do something just to feed yourself and then hope that the big break comes, which sounds like perhaps you're on the road in that direction. Have you always been writing, I guess? When did you actually start writing as a child? Were you a kid writer?
Actually, yes. This is kind of a great question for me because I actually have an answer.
Oh.
So when I was in first grade and living in California, and this is how my mom tells the story. I don't really remember it, but I guess my older sister came home from school with the assignment to write a story. Mm-hmm. And apparently, according to my mom, I said something along the lines of, well, I could write a story if I wanted to. So I sat down and wrote a story. And it was called The Numbers Birthday Party.
Mm.
All the numbers were having party, but zero wasn't invited.
Mm.
You can see the conflict there. So, and it actually ended up making a huge splash at my elementary school.
Mm.
I remember I had to read it to the vice principal in her office. They dittoed copies for everyone in my class, and I had to sit in front of the class and read it while they followed along, and they did a little write-up in the school newsletter thing.
Oh, boy.
I remember being kind of terrified at that age by all the attention.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first story. That's how I got started. And
Had you ever thought you would write a novel before you actually started one, of course?
Yeah. As a kid, I don't know if I did. I mean, I maybe thought about it generally, every once in a while, it'd be cool to be an author kind of thing. My parents owned a bookstore, so I met authors all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They would come into the store and sign, or we would go to book conventions. So I really was immersed in the book world. And so, of course, as a kid, I was like, oh, yeah, it'd be cool to be an author and sign at the Yumba convention and have the yellow tag instead of the blue one for booksellers. But I don't know if I really seriously contemplated it until I, you know, finally sat down and decided to give it a go after college.
So where did the idea for Nova come from?
A lot of my stories start with settings. I like to think of interesting settings that I haven't used before to explore. Nova started with a thought along the lines of, I want to write a story set on a space station. So as I was sort of noodling around with that idea, the line, my name is Leah and I'm a genetically engineered human bomb, popped into my head.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I thought that, I knew I had gold. I was like, oh, this is good.
Mm-hmm. So where is the book available?
The book is available at most retailers. The Books A Million in Town has it. The local store in town has it. So if you're in the Eau Claire area, you can get it locally.
Mm-hmm.
If you shop online, you can get it at Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, BookDepository.com, you know, pretty much any of the main places you'd think of buying books.
Well, the book is Nova. The author is Eau Claire's Margaret Fortune. Nova is available at local area booksellers, and from the usual suspects online. Margaret, thanks so much for being with us. Best wishes on the book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Yes, Jim likes to read, and authors like to talk with him, but he also feels the healthy West Wisconsin pulse of theater.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Great River Shakespeare Festival in Winona will stage The Glass Menagerie tonight, Thursday, Saturday, and Tuesday, and Much Ado About Nothing Friday and Sunday. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will be performing Magic Treehouse, The Night at Dawn, tonight, Thursday, and Friday at the Oxford Theater. The Northern Star Theater of Rice Lake will present Nonsense Amen through Sunday. The Little Shop of Horrors will play Saturday and Sunday at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. The show will continue in repertory through August 20th. The Great River Theater will present Pirates of Penzance through Sunday at Town Square Park in Prescott. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. And the Red Barn Theater of Rice Lake will present Almost May through Saturday. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Thank you. The Volume 1 crowd has taken its first name to heart, added volume to their workload with a new publication just for families that's yet to come. Stepping Stones, the nonprofit, is much like Stepping Stones, the trail. It provides solid footing along a path that may otherwise be slippery or hazardous or difficult. Stepping Stones of Dunn County has helped countless numbers of individuals and families endure and emerge from tough times and rough situations. For that, they're to be congratulated and, more importantly, thanked. One way of doing that is by supporting their efforts, and you can do that in a number of ways. One materializes again this Saturday. The 14th Annual Garden Tour, Our Spectrum Scoop, comes from Jane Reddig, a hardworking Stepping Stones coordinator. How many birthdays has Stepping Stones had, and what's a bit of the history of this fine organization?
Stepping Stones is actually in its 29th year of existence. It started out rather simply as neighbors helping neighbors, someone who recognized the need for elderly people, maybe who would need a trip to the grocery store or a ride to the doctor, mm-hmm. and would connect people in that way. The beginning of the food pantry, was a human services worker who was helping people with food out of her own money, out of her office, and then eventually evolved to a small pantry they had. And then that Stepping Stones took over it, I would say probably 15 years ago, possibly 20 years ago.
Yeah. A lot of nonprofits focus kind of on one area of support, and that seems to be enough. You guys, as you were just mentioning, have three.
We do. We have three programs at Stepping Stones, and we have the food pantry, which is probably the most well-known, the shelter program, and then the community connections program. We have a coordinator for each of the programs. I am the coordinator for the community connections program. Heidi Hooten is the coordinator for the shelter program, and Chris Pawlowski for the pantry program. And it is a lot that we do provide and services we provide. It becomes kind of a one-stop place for people who are looking for either those resources, information on housing, shelter, obviously, food. We're open 6 days a week for the food pantry. Mm-hmm. And we also provide lots of making sure that people have access to the information that they need for services they are available elsewhere.
Yeah, does that happen a lot? Service organizations work together on many things. Is there a coordination there?
We do coordination with other organizations. We work with the churches. We are funded by individuals, businesses, and churches. That makes up about half of our funding, and the remaining part is through United Way and grants that our director is quite busy always writing. We're the only food pantry in town, but there are some in the outlying areas. We work with the schools for the backpack program, the weekend school program for kids, the food program for kids. Mm-hmm. The list is endless, but we do, yes, we work very closely with lots of organizations in town.
A lot of folks don't couple little old Dunn County with the homeless question, and yet there's a definite need for a shelter?
Almost definitely. Our first shelter, we have two shelters. We have five apartments available. It's more transitional housing at this time, probably 4 to 6 weeks. They're always full. There's always a waiting list. In the last 4 years, we operated Winter Haven, which is the overnight warming shelter for the winter, and that's open from November 15th through the end of March. It operated for 3 years in the basement of St. Joe's Catholic Church, and then last year we were operated for the first time in the house next door to our offices as a regular bona fide shelter overnight where we had extended hours and also showers and laundry and the kitchen and things like that for guests to use. We were full many nights and almost full most nights that we were open. There was room for 10 adults, for adults only.
Okay.
And staffed by volunteers all the time when guests are present.
We're talking with Jane Rettig. She's Community Connections Program Director, Coordinator for Stepping Stones of Dunn County. They're in the news because they have their big garden tour this Saturday, which we'll get to in a moment. Food pantries, Jane, are vital to many of us in society. How and is it tough to keep it stocked?
It is a daily operation keeping it stocked. We rely on food donations from the community, and we're very fortunate that we have lots of people and groups and churches, schools, and businesses that do food drives for us. And that helps us to supplement what we purchase from Feed My People, which is, of course, a huge help to us.
Sure.
Because $1 buys $10 worth of food, and we have shipments weekly that we purchase from Feed My People, along with government commodities that we receive monthly for stocking the shelves.
You, as I said, are coordinator of the Community Connections Program. Can you work to define that even a little more for us?
Sure. I continue, actually, some of the work that the original program, how it started with connecting people. People who may need an elderly person who might need a ramp built or a ride to the doctor or maybe a connection to get their lawn raked for the fall. So I connect people with volunteers who might do some of those things. We also do some direct assistance for people who had their electricity disconnected. I work closely with Energy Assistance and Xcel Energy and Dunn Energy. A lot of people, you know, as April 15th rolls around and when things can be disconnected, you know, people end up getting sick, losing their job. It just becomes a spiral down. So we try to respond to some of those needs as much as we can. Also, like if somebody needs to get to a doctor's appointment.
Mm-hmm.
But then along with that, I really work to make sure people are accessing services that they are eligible for. And a lot of education, lots of information, and referral information given. The other part of my job is volunteer coordination. We could not do anything we do at Stepping Stones without our wonderful core of volunteers that staff the pantry, mow the lawn, just do so many things for us at Stepping Stone.
Finding connections and solutions to needs must be pretty interesting. In fact, I'll bet you have to get creative once in a while to discover what someone needs, and awfully satisfying.
It is, and the longer I'm there, I tap into, you know, people I've met or people I've come in contact with years ago who I remember could provide something for someone. And you're right, making those connections, it does take a lot of creativity and connections and sitting down and spending time with people to find out really what their needs are and building those connections to help service those needs as best we can.
Well, you really must be one of the better ambassadors for Stepping Stones. Let's say someone needs a ramp and you find someone who knows how to build that kind of stuff. You have just introduced them to Stepping Stones, whereas they may not have been aware of it in the past. And then that all snowballs. And, you know, it's good public relations for you, too.
It is. And we're fortunate to have a group of retired, mainly Stout professors who do some of that work for us. But you're right, and I think for sometimes we're the last stop for people. A lot of people we work with are on limited income, Social Security, SSI. You're right, it builds those connections and really is a wonderful thing to be able to do that for people.
The satisfying part is, I'm sure, witnessing how willing people are to help when they're made aware of the situation.
Absolutely, and sometimes it's simply inviting people. You know, I think the other part that we do is we provide that opportunity for people to give back to the community, and we have a lot of students, we have interns, people who are really wanting to give back to the community and help people. It becomes a very satisfying opportunity all the way around.
Stepping Stones of Dunn County is a food pantry. It's a shelter program. It's a community connections program. Jane Rettig talking with us today because fundraising is such a big part of what it is you need to do. Let's talk about Saturday's tour, the particulars of it. It is this Saturday, the 27th. It's the 14th annual, as I said, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. What's on the agenda?
Well, we have a lot on the agenda. Yeah, as you said, it's our 14th year, and we have been so fortunate to have these incredibly beautiful gardens to offer on the tour. We have 7 gardens. It's a wide variety of larger gardens, smaller gardens. We try to have a feature garden each year, a teaching educational garden. That's a butterfly garden this year.
Okay.
A retired teacher who has maintained a butterfly garden in his backyard.
Wow.
We also, along with it, have silent auction items at each of the gardens, and those will all be posted. We also, along with it, have a plant sale that will be Thursday, Friday, and Saturday in our Stepping Stones yard from 10 to 4 on Thursday and Friday and 9 to 2 on Saturday, the same time as the garden tour. And that's another big fundraiser for us. And as you mentioned, fundraising is a huge part of us being able to do what we do, and this is our main fundraiser that we do. We're just so thrilled. The weather looks great. The gardeners have all been busy, myself included. I'm on the tour this year. It's been a great spring for our garden tour. Everything's beautiful and blooming and big.
And advance tickets are available at several locations, which I will tell people about. You also have a very active website. What's that address?
Our website is www.steppingstonesdc.org, and there you can see some pictures of the gardens, a few of them. There's also access to online ticket sales and also all of the sites for purchasing prior to the day of the tour. On the day of the tour, tickets are still available at the gardens and at the Stepping Stones office.
Wonderful.
We are very fortunate to have a very active set of sponsors that are listed there that really make this a viable, really wonderful fundraiser for Stepping Stones, and mm-hmm. We're grateful to all of them.
You mentioned the vital word volunteers. You're always looking for help from pocketbooks in the form of supplies and in-kind donations and in warm bodies to lend a hand.
We are, and if anyone is interested in volunteering on our website, go to the menu tab of How Can I Help, and there is our volunteer applications right online that can be completed and emailed directly to me.
Wonderful. Jane Redig, all the best to you and to the folks at Stepping Stones.
Thank you so much. And, you know, I just appreciate you doing this. You know, it's just great.
We talk about the culture of Western Wisconsin, and this is smack dab in the middle of that.
I love public radio. It's all I listen to.
Then we love you, too.
Well, and you're right, and we got to keep it going, don't we?
You bet. Thanks.
Thank you, Al.
Advance tickets available at Bobolink Nursery, Bookends on Main, Kyle's IGA and Colfax, La-Di-Da Gift Shop, Lakeview Floral and Gifts, Lammer's Food Fest, Seasons Harvest Greenhouse, the Stepping Stones office on Stout Road, where the plant sale's also happening, and online at steppingstonesdc.org. Saturday tickets are available at all the gardens as well. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Tickled that you're with us. Support for WPR comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, presenting the surreal work of Madison artist Stephen Hilliard in Seeking the Sublime. It's on exhibit through July 15th. Visit and support information is at mmam.org. Well, Nick Meyer and friends down at the Volume 1 World Headquarters in Eau Claire got together and said, you know, we really don't have enough to do. We need more. And that was in response to all of us saying, we need more. The V1 folks have more than enough on their plates. Thankfully, though, they're willing to give us what we need, and what we told them we needed was a new magazine, an online presence like Volume 1, but this time for families. Mr. Meyer and friends responded.
It's a whole kind of suite of solutions. If you want it on your mobile device, you got it. If you want the content in print, you got it. Mm-hmm. On the website, you want it in your email, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, everything, all the resources, listings, stories are all in all the places.
Events, stories, resources, discussion. Let's talk about those. Events, self-explanatory.
Sure.
Stories, there are subheads there. Community, living, creativity, discovery, activity, perspectives.
Yeah, as we looked at, you know, all the different things that happen in any community, really, related to family activities and happenings and raising kids or having grandkids or whatever stage of any of that you're in or you're thinking about it, we felt that those areas were the things that everything kind of boiled down to. You know, you want activity. You want to get your kids outside and doing stuff in recreation. Discovery is kind of the learning and the school sort of area. Creativity, you know, is music, arts, all those sorts of things. And living is kind of the catch-all. Food or home life, anything like that is kind of the living stuff. And then we have perspectives, too. So there are columns and opinions. And obviously when you get into raising families and having kids, a lot of people have a lot of strong opinions they love to share.
Yes.
So we kind of get that in the mix, too.
It just hit me as you were talking, and we'll go on with these other categories in a moment, but this magazine is for the leaders of the family? It's okay to leave on the coffee table and the kids can go. Is there anything in it for kids that they
No, that's a great question, actually. We did a bunch of input sessions with the community on this as we were getting it going. And a major thing that they wanted to see was content for kids also.
Ah.
But not necessarily, you know, activity pages or whatever, but stories that there are things that they could read about peers of theirs. We have one feature that's kind of a cool kids sort of widget, we call it, where you take just a kid who's doing cool stuff in the community.
Mm-hmm.
In this first issue, it's a kid who's like a very involved in dance. He's really good and really passionate about kind of hip hop dance and everything else. Yeah. So it's just a thing that kids could read about to see what another cool kid's doing. Parents could take interest for their kids and all kinds of stuff. So we have more to add with that to have it have more for children and of different ages. And that's the big thing.
Yeah.
When you have different ages, you know, how do you have content that's great for a six-year-old, that's good for a 10-year-old? I mean, there's all that kind of challenge. So mostly it's for parents and grandparents as a resource to find things to do with the family.
Utopia for you guys would be imagining a family and the dad is going, "Hey, kids, what do you say I read you a story before bedtime tonight? What would you like to hear?" And they go, "Triple Valley Family."
Yeah, right. I don't know if that'll be happening, but that will be our goal. I think you've set a new mission for us.
One of the other links or categories is resources. Now, that is full of stuff. You have water-based fun, tours and attractions, nature and recreation, food and drink, park and sport courts, quick family tips.
It's a big resource. Every season, that'll kind of change out, so you'll see more fall and orchard stuff in the fall and winter activities. So they might not be specific events, but just stuff that's available to you and the family at any time. But then, you dig down further into those listings. It's just a huge comprehensive guide of like every neighborhood park in the whole Chippewa Valley area. Every big town, big park, small park, what they have for playground equipment and everything else. But then also a lot of really important things for families. When we say the word resources, it's kind of things to help you just have your family, people that need assistance in different ways, places to take the kids. You know, we hope to add, we're going to work with the Western Dairyland group in their childcare partnership, filter what you need for childcare and what communities at what times a day and are they certified and a lot of really good information on safe, competent childcare providers. So more, you know, really important, critical life skills resources as well.
Mm-hmm. In the studio with Nick Meyer, he's editor, publisher, and CIEIO of Volume 1. I had a buddy who had that on his business card. The new publication is Chippewa Valley Family, Listings, Guides, and Assistance for Parents and Kids. Then another category is discussion, and that's important. Ask a question, make a statement.
Yeah, and that's a part of the website. And we hope to, once that kind of gets up and kicking and people are having those discussions, which is just getting started now as the website just launched at ChippewaValleyFamily.org. I mean, the magazine's just coming out like as we speak. We hope to incorporate that into print as well. But it's just kind of basically an online forum for people to talk to other parents, get a little bit outside of their own social circles and get a sense of what other people in the community have to say about different family topics.
Yeah.
We always want to get input and have the community be a part of the conversation as well.
Did it feel somewhat easy for you guys to develop this concept? Y'all have growing families.
Actually, this is the year of the baby at Volume 1.
Okay.
Myself and another one of the editors each had our second child this year. Our photographer just had her first child not even a week ago. And one of our advertising guys is having his second child by the end of the year. We're in the throes of it now. But you know, from a technical standpoint, Volume 1 has a lot of this information already, bits and pieces of it.
Yeah.
But we have so much more information and resources and events and these listings, like you talked about, the parks and things, that we just simply don't even have room for in Volume 1 on a regular basis. So this is a much better way to elevate those resources and listings for the people who want them in a more consistent way, so it's always available for
them. Will some of what one finds in Volume 1 now be shifted to Chippewa Valley Family?
That's a good question, an ongoing debate. We have our kid culture section in Volume 1, which covers a little bit of this kind of stuff. For now, all those things will stay in Volume 1 in their abbreviated form, and they'll just be dramatically expanded upon and improved in Chippewa Valley Family.
The development of all of this seems like a natural one to me within the Volume 1 family, because you are a business, but you know the way you say and do things often, it feels like you're admitting that you have a responsibility to do what you do, kind of as a neighbor and a friend and a fellow citizen. Is that fair to say?
I'd like to think so. Yeah. I mean, I think whenever we take on a new project, and this is a big new project for us, we've never launched an entirely standalone publication outside of Volume 1 before. You know, there's kind of a gut check for us and a lot of conversations that happen of, you know, is this the right thing to do? Does this add enough value to the community in enough different ways that this is worth our time and energy? And this is something where every one of those boxes was checked off. There was an opportunity there to improve kind of the family media scene, so to speak. And all these guides are there for the events and the resources and things. But really what we're trying to do, you know, what we did with Volume 1 was kind of elevate that arts and culture community of the Chippewa Valley and kind of show everybody how much was happening and make these connections for people, and they could kind of connect themselves then and, mm-hmm. and can continue to flourish through that. And I think 13 years later, we've succeeded on that at some level. And the same thing is true in the family scene. Everybody says this is a great place to raise a family, and there's a lot of things happening, but it's all a little disjointed, and there's no one gathering spot for all that information, for that discussion, for those perspectives. And so we're trying to elevate what we all know to be true of that this is a great place to raise a family and take it even further. And that can have economic development benefits to the community, you know, a lot of personal and social benefits to the people reading, but it has a bigger societal gain. I mean, so it's a big, ambitious, lofty goal. Mm-hmm. But I think after, you know, several years of doing this publication, I think we'll see the same thing happen that we've seen with Volume 1.
Well, it's not as if we don't have enough to do here at Volume 1.
That's too true, a little too close to home there. But the we have so many amazing contributors of all walks of life and all spots in their lives, many of whom are parents, moms and dads and even grandparents who have tons of ideas. And so this is something that's been kind of percolating for a while. Get these stories out there in a format that maybe made them a little more meaningful to people, like being surrounded by family content. So the ideas come from all of our contributors, from all of our staff, and hopefully now from readers as well.
The publication's called Chippewa Valley Family on newsstands. Take us to an editorial meeting or a staff meeting at Valley. What do you call it? Probably has a real weird name.
Actually, it's kind of weird. They call them budget meetings, which you'd think would be about numbers and things, but it's your budgeting space for the issue. What do you have space for? So you'd be budgeting your
airtime. Sounds like something I wouldn't want to go to.
Me either, but that's, I guess, what the professionals call them. And so I just started calling it that because some of the people I had hired started calling it that. So it's a budget meeting. We just, you know, for Chippewa Valley Family, it's all new to us too. We take a good look at what's happening in this coming cycle as far as events.
How often do you meet?
Well, we get kind of a cool newsroom. We call it the quad out there. There's four editors, and they're always talking about ideas and making notes on things. But every 2 weeks, we get together for a big editorial meeting or a budget meeting. If we look at what's coming up, what are the ideas, what has been pitched to us, what are we pitching to each other? And through that, you kind of build the framework for an issue, and then you talk to contributors and what are they interested in, who are experts in different areas, and you build an issue.
I have four words here. Tell me how much they mean to your staff. Insightful, thoughtful, influential, credible. Those all important things, I would guess, to you guys?
Well, yeah. I think, I mean, anytime that you're in a position of, you know, media, or they people look at you as an authority of some kind, so credible is important that way, and you want to have things be accurate and true. Insightful was in there.
Thoughtful. Thoughtful is huge in what you do.
The thoughtfulness, I think, comes through in what we call letters and columns. So that's where we're really considering, what does it mean to live in this community? What are we all collectively doing together? Where are we moving? What are we moving towards? That's kind of where that thing comes in. That's the same thing with insightful. I would say those are kind of...
And influential is the other word, and that's media nowadays wants to perceive themselves as influential.
Yeah, I think there is, that can be a double-edged sword in modern media. I mean, you can be influential in a detrimental sort of way. We like to try to talk about things that matter and tackle issues. We don't do a lot of, you know, negative stuff, but we try to take big thoughts in Volume 1 and break them down. We do our big theme issues. Like last fall, we did our Rebuilding Our Neighborhoods theme issue and talking about what is the state of neighborhoods in America today and in the Chippewa Valley. Get people talking and thinking about these things. And we know a couple of new neighborhood associations formed after that. It got people thinking. And the Putnam Heights neighborhood in Eau Claire came together and formed for the very first time, which is a really cool and gratifying thing to hear. But, you know, really, when it comes to influential, that's for other people to decide, you know, whether or not that's the case with any of us as media.
It's not often people get the old Spectrum West microphone. So now that you have it, anything else you want to talk about? Anything else you want to tout? What's going on? You got the summer concert series, Sounds Like Summer.
Oh, gosh. Those summer concerts are just crazy at this point. I mean, the amount of people showing up for those is just so substantial. I mean, we don't have official counts, but we're sending up a drone, actually, next week.
Oh, cool.
We're working with Market & Johnson. They've got fancy drone equipment.
Yes, they
do. We're sending one up to get a good look at the crowd from the air. it's just even with the parking is bad this year because they're building the new ramp. So there's no parking, but people are just finding their way there. I mean, a couple thousand people every week. It is a full-blown festival every week. It's so much fun. Also, though, we have a very special theme issue coming up. We're doing one called Music Capital of the North,
wow,
where we are in advance of the new Eau Claire Music Festival and just a few weeks after the new Blue Ox Bluegrass Festival and, of course, taking all the other ones that already exist. What does it mean here? What does it mean to the economy, to tourism, to the cultural and social life here? And it's a big fancy theme issue that'll be out on July 8th, and it'll be online at volume1.org/musiccapital.
It's something to be proud of, but one may worry about diluting.
Too many musicians,
too many music festivals.
No, that's true. I mean, there's a lot to that. I mean, it's, I think they're all hitting different crowds, but
yeah,
we got to get them all on different weekends to begin with. They're always competing. The solution is to get more people from out of town, to increase the tourism component. So you're bringing in outside money to go to those things and spend it and keep it here so we don't have to, as locals, support everything entirely ourselves. So the more we can get the message out about the cultural riches, just like you do every week here, the better off we're going to be in the long run.
Well, I have an idea. Why don't we build a new theater?
Good.
And maybe a hotel or two.
Yes.
Nick Meyer, thanks for being with us. And again, congratulations. Best of luck with Chippewa Valley family. And keep up the great work with Volume 1 and all your other things you have your hand in.
Thank you, Al. Always a pleasure.
The magazine is on newsstands, and the online experience has this address, ChippewaValleyFamily.org. Couple of Spectrum memoranda. Tonight, Thursday, the Sounds Like Summer Concert Series at Phoenix Park in Eau Claire features Eggplant Heroes, Klez Mazel, yes, and Sean Jordan. That's at 6:30 p.m. Thursday evenings, Tower Park in Colfax is the site of music performances. Tonight, local musician Jordan Herrick plays at the fairgrounds as part of the Colfax Free Fair, no Tower Park concert. They resume July 2nd. And that features the Ukulele Club of Eau Claire. Oh, okay. There's music in Memorial Park and Ladysmith each Thursday. Tonight, they have an Elvis impersonator. You know what I'm going to say. Thank you very much. Saturday, the Northern Lakes Center for the Arts in Amory presents America, America, favorite readings and audience sing-alongs accompanied by the Northern Lakes Chamber Orchestra to celebrate Independence Day. That starts at 7:30 p.m. Shell Lake Art Center's Jazz Combo faculty and Extreme Strings instructor Randy Sabine play a free concert Monday evening, 7:30. That's the Lakefront Pavilion. Lots more going up all next week as part of their music camps. So check them out at shelllakeartcenter.org. Thank you, CJ, for the words of promotion, Mrs. Brown for the guidance, Dean Kallenbach for being a good big cheese for and with whom to function, and thanks to you for giving me a reason to sit here and talk into this vocal magnifier every week. Next week, the Chippewa Valley Jazz Orchestra looks ahead to an exciting season. There's a new winery in the hills near River Falls and more. I'm Al Ross. Thanks. See you.